Well, thanks very much for kicking off the weekend. Yeah, it was a very interesting, yes, thought-provoking talk. And yeah, there'll be a transcript of the talk available in the publication. But I'll hand that out towards the end of the weekend rather than straight away. And also as well, I'm sure Keith might be saying this, but there's a couple of his books on the bookshelf over there if you fancy picking one of them up later. I'm sure he'll sign a copy for you. Simon was first off the bat with his hand up, so yeah, go ahead, Simon.
Yeah, I've a suggestion that it seems to me that there are two approaches to Marxism, which are, they're not separated, they're connected by discontinuity. And one of them is dealing with capitalism, where at the very end of dealing with capitalism, the working class is now in control of capital. And then the other, where the precondition of socialism is the working class in control. But between them, you have this discontinuity of how the working class transforms itself as it approaches the seizure of power, in the same way that, for example, if we were storming the gates of heaven, we might find that we became angels and the gates became paradise, if you sort of mean, as we approached it. So just using a metaphor, what I'm saying is that you transform yourselves in the process of struggle. Now, it tends to be seen, I think, by not only by most Marxists, but also I think within our own party. And you know that one of my favourite hobby horses is attacking the Socialism Practical Alternative pamphlet. But that's for another day. But the point is that even after the working class has seized complete control of capitalism, its revolutionisation is then seen in terms of private property, in the suppression of it, but at the same time, the revolutionisation, I really haven't bit of the word there, sorry, of the working class, is seen to happen internally. It's something good that happens to us while we're dealing with the fact that we're getting 100% of our product rather than having to give 20% to a boss. Whereas if you look at it from the other perspective, like seeing socialism with working class control as the precondition, you see that that transformation has actually led to a completely different world in which you live, because capitalism is a set of relationships in the same way that socialism is going to be a set of relationships. My main draw for this, for being Marx's opinion, is from the Paris manuscripts, which hobby horse number 5, 6, or 7 or something, where the section in excerpts on James Mill, where he ends up saying, our productions would be as so many mirrors in which our true natures would shine forth. At least it says that in the New Left edition, which is quite poetic. But my point is that if you look at that, Marx is explicit from the beginning of seeing how it's not just capitalists who think in a capitalist way, but it's workers who think in a capitalist way in capitalism. Yeah? And it is obvious to him that his new society, at least in the Paris manuscripts, involves this alchemy of the working class to now being a completely different creature, which now expresses its world in a different way. So I think that our approach to Marxists, so-called, could be that they just leave us with this barren world where we control the working class is that now controls capitalism, but they haven't got the notion in there of why we did it, of how instead of just having 100% instead of 80%, now we have a qualitatively different world. But I think that criticism also applies to the party.
To come back on that?
Well, there's an awful lot there, and I can't address it all in one go, I think. One thing I would set aside, question of, I don't know, Marx scholarship in a sense. Marx left a huge quantity of words behind, as I said. Some of these got published in his own lifetime, some didn't. And the Paris manuscripts are a case of the latter. Myself, I think it's much more reliable to refer to things that Marx himself chose to see through the printing press, rather than things that people picked up after he died. I mean, I certainly would want to be judged on what I'd chosen to publish rather than jottings which I'd shoved to the back of the drawer. And in Marx's case, he might have been just trying out a new pen and ink. And, it's difficult to know whether that's an abiding part of his position or not. So setting that aside, I mean, I take it your main point, which is a really, really good point to raise. If a socialist society is supposed to be a democratically organised society where people participate voluntarily and in cooperation with each other, where do you get to the point where the working class is capable of doing that? You can't wait till socialism is established, because that's in a sense too late, because it could not be run in the form in which it has to exist. Now, what that suggests to me is that some transformations have to take place in capitalism itself, and there's going to be many, many different aspects of that. But one important aspect is the political movement itself, which exists to bring about a capitalist society. And that's why it's of enormous importance, I think, for the party to have impeccably democratic practices. And, you know, running a political party is not the same thing as running a society. But there is an overlap between those two things. And it's in that context where I think some of the skills have to be built up that would be needed and useful in a socialist society.
Any other? Bill? Yeah.
Just two things. One, I mean, I put on the online forums a few months back. There, I came across on YouTube an anime series from China, which was a biopic, an animated biopic of Karl Marx's life, in which they used extensive quotes from his actual works. But what was interesting, apart from the fact that they conformed to the genre, and made him this very somber authority figure, was how they had to strip out the radicalism of when they were talking about capital and turn it into something sort of like just a kind of more like a pity for the poor kind of thing, rather than this, as you say, express call to abolish capitalism. But just following on in terms of that, rather than what Karl Marx would do today, I think the slightly better theoretical exercises: what would happen had Karl Marx never existed? And I was thinking that as a way of proving his own theme. Because if Karl Marx never existed, there would have still been Left-Ricardians, there would have still been a Social Democratic Party in Germany, there would have still been an awful lot of what he talked about would have been talked about and eventually have happened. And of course, then there would have been this cross-influence of the Social Democrats in Germany to the revolutionaries in Russia. A Russian revolution would still have happened, but it would have been in the name of Smith rather than Marx or something like that. And it's, I think it's, that's just perhaps another fruitful way of approaching the question about Marx's relation to his own theories. What would have happened had he not existed at all?
And yeah, that's a nice point. I mean, maybe if Marx hadn't existed, somebody would have had to invent him.
Is the film worth watching? I don't know if we could sort of share the title or something later on.
I can't remember the title. I'd have to look at it. It's enjoyable. I mean, it's a series. It's like six half-hour episodes.
Yeah.
With subtitles. But it's very amusing.
Yeah. Maybe sort of try and post a link or something somewhere.
Yeah.
Any other questions? I've sort of got one. Howard here.
Yeah, this raises the question of some of the things that Keith said and what was said behind me raised the question of the extent to which the working class will have to be revolutionary, as it were, will have to know how to organise socialism before they actually vote for it, before they take political action. I think the answer to that is they'll have to be very, very, very revolutionary, very, 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 very. The consciousness will have to be extremely high. In other words, there'll have to be sort of overwhelming socialist consciousness before they even attempt to bring in socialism. Otherwise, it just won't work.
Mm-hmm.
Quite clearly, it won't work because there'll be, a significant proportion of the population who won't really know what it's all about, and will almost be in the sort of position Lenin talks about, and they're needing to be led, and then that can't work. So I think that, what's been said, what Keith and Simon have said, sort of, raises that very important point. Mm-hmm. And in connection with that, there's I don't know whether anybody ever looks at a publication called The Weekly Worker. It's a paper produced by the Communist Party of Britain, which has got all, the former CPGB, etc. And it's got all sorts of stuff in that we wouldn't agree with. But they've got a very open letters policy. Anyone can write, and you're virtually certain to get published, unless you're talking absolute gibberish. And several party members have had letters in the Weekly Worker. And there's one this very week written by Robin Cox, which covered this extremely well. If anyone gets a chance to look at it, you find it online. It's very easily accessible. He sort of in response to what another letter said previously, he sort of tackles and, in my opinion, answers that question very effectively.
Thank you. Thanks.
If I could abuse chair's privilege, if no one's got their hands up otherwise. Something Simon said sort of reminded me that my sort of route into Marx was through his sort of early philosophical works, the thesis on Feuerbach, partly because they're very brief and quite easy to read. I did a sort of philosophy degree around about the same time. So I had that sort of mindset, and my sort of introduction into Marx was the more sort of philosophical angle he took at the start of his career. And the way I see it is that, his early philosophical stuff, it sort of provides the bones, if you like, and his later economic stuff puts on the sort of the flesh. I mean, I haven't really made the effort to go into that bit, but the way I saw it was that Marx was, for me anyway, sort of primarily a philosopher who then went on to more so than most other philosophers sort of beef things up with lots of empirical evidence from the real world, which both sort of proves a revolutionary point, but also makes a philosophical point as well, especially about and you can stretch his theories to cover things like the mind body problem, ethics, I suppose. So you can sort of have that angle into Marx, and a couple of other party members who sort of took the more economic way into Marx and had that sort of economic emphasis on his work. One or two have been a bit sort of disparaging about sort of the early philosophical stuff. And I suppose it's sort of, it's where my mind is tuned on the philosophical stuff rather than all the economic stuff. But I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that, about if you read Marx picking up on all the economic, I know economic stuff's a rather, rather shoddy way of putting it, but hopefully you know what I mean. Sort of looking at things with the sort of, economic glasses on, I don't know if that's anything better as an analogy, or the sort of philosophical side, which maybe has been sort of downplayed a bit, especially since the 60s. Are those two sort of approaches into Marx complementary, contradictory, combative? I was just wondering if you had sort of any particular sort of views on sort of ways into Marx and ways of reading Marx.
Well, where to start with? putting it in a broader perspective, we can't just say that Marx was a philosopher, or he was an historian, or he was an economist. We can't just say that, although it is true that he was all of those things. But what's also true, I think, is that at various points and in various ways, he produces challenges to the fundamental basis of those intellectual disciplines. And I suppose one of the things that I think about the early philosophical stuff is that that would have fallen prey to the criticisms of Marx's own later position. So that's not much of an answer. It's the beginning of an answer, I hope.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Sound. Yeah. Cheers. Yes, Brian.
Yeah. If there's many different kinds of Marxisms, actually, and if you look at it kind of chronologically, you've got first of all after Engels, and you've got the social democratic movement and whatnot, and then we get the Russian Revolution and the emergence of Marxist Leninism and Bolshevism. And the offshoots from that, Stalinism, all the varieties of Trotskyism. Then you've got a reaction against that with all the kind of left communists and whatnot. And then going closer to the present, you've got all the sort of theoretical Marxism, you know, the humanistic Marxism with people like Fromm, you've got the analytical Marxism, you've got the structure Marxism, the things. Could you actually say, as time's got on, that Marxism has got farther away from Marx?
It depends which bits of evidence you look at, but certainly there are pieces of evidence that would support that view. I don't think I can say much more than that, really. It does, the variety of things called Marxism, I think, just reinforces the need to ask that question, how close is Marx to these different kinds of Marxism? And how you answer that will depend on other assumptions you make, like published versus unpublished stuff, early stuff versus late stuff or not. So the whole complex of different approaches and positions that can be taken.
Anyone tuning in, got their hand up? No? Okay.
Nobody else is going to...
Yes,
Howard. You mentioned Jerry Cohen. Didn't he go sort of very much off the rails in his later writings? He more or less rejected the kind of thing he was saying earlier. Am I wrong about that?
His later writing certainly interested me very much less than what he had to say about Marx.
Weren't they about Marx?
No, not his later stuff, no.
He's not around anymore, is he now, right?
No, he died 14, 15 years ago.
Right, okay.
Simon?
Yeah, I just wanted another bite of this cherry. You've suggested that, I mean, really you're presenting a sort of Althusserian break between his earlier and later works, just without the Althusser. I was suggesting that if it wasn't, if his early works weren't published, that they don't matter. I think that they do, and I think that the rejection on the basis of looking at later works and saying, well, there's a lot about pounds, shillings and pence and all that sort of thing, I don't think it washes because of the sort of the alchemical nature of his understanding of not only the classes but the world that they're in, that basically that we express the worlds that we are living in at given times by our class formations, and as we change the nature of class that we are, as we change the way we see the world, we change the world that we make. So, but the point is that all those properties are on board rather than somehow in the heavens. So we are the ones changing those. So if you then look on later and say that he's dealing with these what look like rather prosaic properties, that doesn't mean that he's deserted the sort of Sturm und Drang of the transformational process. And I mean, I'm not doing this to be like a slightly better paid worker, I have to tell you. That's not what I'm in this for. But I think that rather than... if you actually look at the way that Marx was setting himself up in those early writings, I don't think you can say that they're missing in the later works. And if you look, for example, at something like, a good way of looking at this, I suppose, is The Dialectics of Nature from Engels. And you wonder, well, you know, did Engels pass this part of Marx before he wrote all it? I don't know the point by that. But you can look at when Engels is talking about the dialectical nature of water turning into steam. And if you look at it in a scientific frame of reference, it's all rubbish. But if you look at it in terms of the way that we perceive and the way that we create properties in order to manage the world around ourselves, it makes perfect sense. And I think that we should be looking at Marx in that second sense rather than the first one. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, to clarify what I said earlier on, I don't think I'm saying that the early works don't matter. What I am saying is that there is stuff there in Marx, as with many other writers and thinkers, which hasn't had the endorsement of being brought out and shown to the world. And it's for that reason particularly tricky to know what views to attribute to him later on in his career. There just hasn't been that kind of endorsement. Maybe he was just trying his pen out when he wrote this, you know, if he didn't choose to publish it. And I suppose what I have to say is that my preference for the later stuff is that it has a degree of concreteness which I don't find in Leonid stuff, and which I think chimes better as a helpful and informative description of the world that we live in. It's less airy-fairy, less abstract. Now that it seems to me, would get Marx off the hook of some of the criticisms I'm making of the early stuff. It wouldn't do much for Althusser, and that's fine by me.
But it does put you firmly in that part one of the working class taking control of capitalism, rather than my proposed part two of it being a precondition for the formation of a socialist society that's qualitatively different, by choosing those later works that seem to tie into, we're going to be talking about type 1 and type 2 industry or whatever it is. I don't know if that was Marxist phraseology, but you know what I mean, to look at capitalism in its own terms rather than what would be working class terms of saying, well, we don't want anything to do with this.
Yeah, I think you've lost me on that last point.
Well, never mind.
Sorry.
Well, come back to it. I mean, there's a whole weekend of we've got to chew the fat. Someone got there online first, Dougie. Yeah, so
I've got Adam.
Yep, go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, I'm just testing whether you can hear me. Can you?
Only
just about.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to have to talk for half an hour tomorrow.
Sound.
I think that's Adam with my form F from the branch.
Yeah. That bleep was a bit louder.
Yeah. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah.
That's even quieter. Right.
The point I was going to make was, Bill raised an important point. What if Marx had never existed? Because in one sense, the very term Marxism contradicts Marx's theory of history, which downplays the contribution of so-called great men, and says things would have happened anyway.
I suppose he is a long way away.
Yeah. Is there any tweaking you can do, Piers?
Well, that's
big enough. Everything except Max.
Yeah. Sorry, Adam, we couldn't catch that well enough to... unless people sort of type a quick question in the chat and then that could be read out.
Let's try another one. Yes,
this problem needs to be solved before.
Yes, yeah, it does. Yeah, we've got just over 12 hours to sort it out. Tomorrow we might be using the venue's own rig rather than the laptop. Is there anything else you can do to tweak it? Here's a... Oh, that was
turn off. Turn off. Try again, Adam.
Well, what I was saying was...
That's better.
The very term Marxism is incompatible with Marx's theory of history, which plays down the importance of great men or individuals. So even if he hadn't have existed, there would still be a socialist movement, there'd still be an understanding about how capitalism works and so on, but it wouldn't be called Marxism. It might be called scientific socialism, but... I think that the reason why we can continue to call ourselves Marxists or Marxians is to just demonstrate that we're not anti-Marxists or anti-Marxians.
Right. The beginning of that, just in case anyone didn't hear, was, correct me if I've misinterpreted, but Adam was saying that Marxism is incompatible with the materialist conception of history, to the extent that the materialist conception of history downplays the role of great individuals, in inverted commas. And if Marx is elevated, then that goes against the thread of the materialist conception of history. That was the first part of what you said, I think, Adam, just for the benefit of others in the room.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, it was the word Marxism rather than Marxism, yeah.
Right, yeah. Keith, anything to...
Yeah, it's a nice point being made, I think, that the ideas would have surfaced whether Marx is around or not, and if they had, we might be talking using a different vocabulary, or at least one that didn't contain his name. And that might forestall an awful lot of the criticisms that we have to pick up now because that name is... in currency.
Okay, thanks, Ducky.
Yeah, I'm just talking about, you know, the world as it is, you know, the way the billionaires are getting much richer and everybody else is struggling around here. You've got Elon Musk going to be a trillionaire or whatever, you know. And, you know, people with a lot of money, they just need to put it in the bank and they get 5% or whatever, you know, so maybe a few million pounds every month or whatever. And that's the way it operates. So workers have to understand the economics of capitalism and why you need to abolish money, really, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the tenets of Marxism that I can see. I mean, in the Communist Manifesto, it talked about labour virtues and things, but really, you know, we've moved away from that, you know, that we have to abolish money to stop these monsters with a trillion dollars or whatever, you know, just exploiting workers. And I mean, you do get some billionaires that give their money away or spend it on vaccines, you know, like Bill Gates, but most of them are monsters like Elon Musk, or, you know, and the politicians that get voted in tend to be billionaires in America, right, you know, and they're out for what they can get, right, you know. So I think you've got to take it to the real world and see that Marxism is about understanding capitalist economics and moving away from that, really, you know.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's what we've got to do, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, I can't disagree with that. I'm trying to think now, I think it's Oscar Wilde in Soul of Man Under Socialism, says that the cruelest slave owners were the ones that were kind to their slaves, because that just distracted attention away from the whole system of exploitation. And I mean, I think that, you know, he was making that point about one form of society with an implicit criticism of another one.
Right.
And it's that other explicit criticism which I think you're taking up, and rightly so.
Bill?
Going back to Karl Marx and his commitment to democracy, and it's always certainly very interesting when you look at things like the changes he made or he brought about in the rules of the Communist League, and changing it from being a conspiracy, a conspiratorial organisation, something that looks much more like a modern political party. And I believe that there was actually a lot of correspondence that he burnt in his lifetime from his activism as an actual member of, you know, International Working Men's Organization and other practical organizations. But also his very well-deserved reputation for being a superb factionalist. And he was fairly ruthless about, you know, he'd do all the shabby tricks if he could, including, you know, taking committee members home for a couple of glasses of wine before the meeting to make sure that he'd get the vote to go his way. But this is just by way of probing back into, you mentioned the famous quote, "I'm not a Marxist," which I believe was referring to some of the younger members, I think some of his son-in-laws, within organised labour who were not calling themselves Marxists within his lifetime. And I think you said you maybe in this discussion address that famous phrase.
Yes, I mean, if he said it, I mean, the evidence we're saying is that Engels wrote to someone and said that Marx said it. It's not direct, but setting that aside, let's suppose that he did say it. What he was implicitly being critical of was the position taken up by some French socialists, which we would call anti-reformism. So it's a kind of it's a potential source of embarrassment of the party that in the context in which he says he's no Marxist, he looks to be implicitly endorsing reformism.
Right.
Yeah. Which shows he wasn't right about everything.
Yeah, the source of that quote, Marx allegedly or supposedly saying I'm not a Marxist. Yeah, there's something else in the publication which gives the source of that. There's also a bit in there about the Communist Manifesto as well, which Dougie mentioned. So tease the publication you'll get at the end of the weekend a bit. Any other contributions, either in the room or virtually? A bit early to call it a night, unless everyone's really gagging for a pint.
thought you'd never notice.
Yeah. Any other? No one else online raising their hand?
Yeah.
So again, online, yeah, if people... go for it, Simon.
I do think on the subject of reformism, or reformism, as that's known in various circles, it is a little problematic when you ask, why are you having to be purist? Do you see what I mean? Because there's reforms. There's things that are an obvious and absolute benefit to the working class, and there are things that are just basically, you know, the butcher's running away and he's chucking a couple of sausages to the dog so they don't follow him anymore, sort of thing. And we don't, you know, we also don't allow for the notion of there being genuine working class representatives who just don't see it our way. This is about to burst onto the scene as a serious consequence, because we know there's like this new party forming with over 800,000 people. Different people have got different opinions on it, but it's going to be a left Labour Party with a democratic socialist a package of reforms and whatever, and we are going to have to deal with it, so we should get our heads around it now. And it's going to be a very, if not 800,000, it's still going to be a very large movement. So we're not going to just do what the, you know, media said and doesn't ignore it. We're going to have to say something. But I think what it is, and this is going back to my model, which is now becoming Hobby Horse 13A or something, about up to and including all of capitalism as a working class, and then the working class control being the precondition for a socialist society, is that it is precisely because we do not have an adequate notion of how that alchemy works that we have, you know, what a future socialist society would look like, that we have to abolish any notion of reformism in our more of a prosaic approach to capitalism, because if we have that, there's a reason for it to stop short of where we want it to go. Do you see what I'm saying? That it is only by being absolutist with respect to capitalism that we can avoid discussing what a future socialist society would be, apart from just saying we own it all.
Say that last bit again, sir.
I'm saying that we have an absolutist approach to capitalism. No reformism, no reforms, no nothing. Everyone's got to know what's going on before we start going. Everything's got to go by the numbers. We take everything off the capitalists, and one day they wake up and they're shaken quietly from their beds, not stabbed in their beds, because that frightens the punters. Yeah. And then after that, it's like, you know, the last capitalist or whatever the book is, that they hand over the keys and we've got everything. So it's like, and we control capitalism now. And now, but because we've now got it as an entire thing, we've not made any compromises, we've not had to fudge around with politics, we've not had to fudge around with subsidising industry or anything like that. We now have our absolute society, that this is socialism. So we don't have to talk about that flip side of the coin. That one where, as I was saying about, as you storm the gates of heaven, you actually, you change yourself and the gates change. Yeah? As we storm capitalism, we change as workers. And the society we live in changes, because at the end of the day, it's a set of relationships that we carry on board. We are both actors and theatre. Yeah? So, but if we just look at capitalism as, you know, we're just going to take it all, we're not going to have any compromises, we get to this 100% end, we don't have to ask what that 101 is. That what happens when we stop being workers and the world that we're in stops being a world of private property. Yeah. When instead of just having one dull world that we have to be born, live and die in, we have a myriad of possibilities available to us, and our problem is the older folks bonking us on the head saying, no, stop doing that, we just want you to explore the case of world socialism, thank you very much. Yeah. There's so much more to what socialism should be in terms of our development. And we would have to address that if our class struggle was less. Does that make sense?
A bit more, yeah. Keith, did you want to...
I think what really distinguishes the party from any other organisation is its principled opposition to reformism. You know, abolish the wages system, abolish money, this and that. You can look hard enough, you can find those commitments in other organisations. What the party does is add to that a rejection of reformism. Why does that matter? Well, it matters because reformism has had its chance. It's had 150 years of trying to get rid of capitalism, or the worst evils of capitalism. That's where millions and millions and millions of people have put their efforts. And it's failed. Mm-hmm. And if it's failed, we should try something else. Maybe we should try and galvanise people to reject capitalism in its entirety.
Okay, anyone online? Anyone else in the room?
In that connection, it would have been extremely interesting to hear Cat Rylance's talk.
Indeed,
about non-reformist reform. It's a pity we weren't able to hear it. Perhaps you'll... Have we got a copy of it, in fact? No.
And I'll say some of the points that have come up, you know, we can explore them again later on in the weekend. Yes, Phil?
Well, just on this, it's called recently because there's been lots of talk online and in the media about inheritance tax and Labour's battle for Cage by even slightly tweaking it, which led me to going and looking up what Mark said about inheritance tax, because he did actually have something to say. Now, there is a possibility that he had a bit of a self-interest in the question of inheritance. So his opposition to large inheritance taxes, because he did write to the workers' movement saying, no, we don't want a large inheritance, it would just scare people. And if we had a majority to actually impose an inheritance tax as a workers' movement, we would have the majority to expropriate capital. And so his own argument is very similar to some of the stuff that we say. If we get to this point where we have the political power to end capitalism, we should do that rather than doing anything like, you know, tweaking various forms of taxation. And it's very expressed in the kind of, and whenever I look at, you know, the writings, you know, Engels on the housing question, he goes blah 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 blah, and of course the working class needs to organise for political power. We phrase it much more in the terms of, you know, common democratic ownership, control of means of production, etc. But they're very simplistic a lot of the time in their writings of this complicated problem, the working class need to organise to come to power. And to, you know, it's come to power first, I suppose, is as far as I can see, their approach.
Yep. Fine.
Anyone else at all? No. No one else online?
No.
Okay. Yes, Richard. Yeah.
Yeah, just on this question of reforms. I mean, there's a body. Treads this rather delicate, does this rather delicate dance about reforms, doesn't it? We're anti-reformism, but we're not entirely anti-reforms if we believe that they in fact do bring positive benefit to the working class while capitalism still exists, and we will speak out and say so. Now, as an administrator of a couple of online Facebook pages, WSM page and an SPGB page, I'm always, there is always this kind of post that comes through that somebody comes and sort of, and I have to do this dance in my own mind about whether I kind of allow it or not allow it on the grounds that, okay, it's kind of, is proposing reform, but like for example, I got one the other day. It's actually a petition to the government to stop sending military aid to the Israelis. Now, you know, it's like where does this actually fit into our position on this? I mean, we are. If I allowed it, it would imply that we were for petitioning governments, capitalist governments, and so promoting a sort of reformist point of view. But on the other hand, I mean, I don't know any socialist who would sort of like, who is not concerned with the position of the working class in Gaza. Most Palestinian, I mean, there are capitalists in Gaza, although most of them now live abroad, most Palestinian capitalists live abroad. But it's like, it's such a delicate position, and I understand that, you know, you are always going to be faced by contradictions and compromises if you are somebody who is advocating for one, for the abolition of the present state of things, but at the same time still actually having to live within that state of things at the same time. So I'm just wondering what, I mean, this has always been a juggling match that I've always kind of keenly felt, and I'm just wondering what the police or anybody else might think about it.
No, I think you give an accurate account of the party's position and the stresses and strains that result from it. Reformism is one thing, particular individual reforms are another, and we support them if they benefit the working class. What's wrong with that? Well, one thing that makes me slightly uneasy is there are not going to be many reforms which benefit the whole entire working class. And that means that supporting them is potentially divisive. Mm-hmm. And I think that the one thing which is a kiss of death for creating socialist consciousness is divisiveness amongst working people.
I suppose on that point, again, if I can abuse chair's privilege, and I suppose, again, it's maybe sort of stretching the theme of the talk, but on the whole reformism thing, I mean, my own view is that there's something a bit reformist about unions. I'm not in a union because, they fight for most mainstream unions, I should say. I think the IWW's a bit different. But yeah, with the sort of the mainstream unions, yeah, they fight for sort of things to be immediately better for the working class. But as with other reforms, there's the problem that will divert people's attention into that as a sort of a full-time model. I know that that's not the predominant view in the party, but yeah, I think there's a bit of a whiff of reformism in unions, most unions. I was just wondering if anyone else or what Marx himself might have thought about that. Simon and then Paddy.
Yeah, two things. If we can't oppose a genocide, we should wind ourselves up. And if we can't be pro-union, then we should wind ourselves up. Those two things, I mean, amongst many things that should cause us to collapse in disgust, I think those two are there. Unionism, no matter how awful unions are, they are the basic mechanism that we have whereby workers self-organise. Now, I know there's an argument in the early party and it ended up with a non-compromise where they just agreed not to talk about the issue or something silly like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it came to a deadlock vote and they agreed not to do it again. But I don't think that we, in good faith, should be able to say to workers that they should not join a union, regardless of how awful that union is. I mean, for example, when I was in another place, when I was still a member of the Labour Party, I went to their conference in 21, where I attended as a delegate from my branch, and within 5 minutes realised I was a spectator. And the reason I realised that is because the whole of the party branch organisation had arrived to get rid of David Evans and then by token Starmer and the rest of the NEC, but we found out they were stitched up by one person, Christine McAnay, who was the General Secretary of Unison. So we all came along with our branch votes to do X, and she wielded about 2 million odd votes to Y, and she had the stitch up and she got made a dame out of it. That does not mean that I'm going to tell people they shouldn't join Unison. It just means that Unison was a catastrophe, and we should be telling them you should do differently next time. Because in the Unison case, it's the one that I know of. It's that they've got this apostolic succession that only works for the right wing of the Labour Party rather than working for the membership, and the membership needs to be strong enough to break it. Yeah? But we can't turn around to people and say, don't join unions.
and there's a lot of other things that we may think that doesn't fit our pure notion of what a revolutionary organisation is, but if we've got nothing to say about it, we shouldn't tackle with it.
I don't think I hear anybody saying that you shouldn't join a union.
No, I didn't.
But what I think needs to be introduced into the discussion is a distinction between what individual party members might do and what the party as an organisation might do.
Paddy?
I was just going to support the point that you were making about unions in a way. I had a conversation with some anarchist friends of mine who are quite involved in, you know, union activity in London. And we were having a discussion one day about our position, our sort of no-compromise position, and how, I mean, everybody here knows that we often get accused of not taking part in the class struggle, of being a sort of ivory tower. We don't dirty our hands, this sort of idea, you know, because of this no-compromise. And so you could describe that as the rock, as in the rock and the hard place. And the hard place is where the anarchists are situated, working with the unions, when their experience is that the unions and strikers are very, very happy to have that involvement from anarchists, but they only really want to talk about the strike. They only really want to talk about the union. They don't really want to expand the discussion in the way that anarchists want. And of course, some trot outfits do this kind of thing as well. And so that's the hard place, the rock and the hard place. And so I think my view is that we take the position we do. All the other positions are also, as you said, they're also already taken. So if there's some kind of other position that turns out to be right and it's not ours, well, we will see that because they'll succeed. None of them have succeeded. So, you know, I think it's still... We're still stuck where we are, they're stuck where we are, and workers just aren't interested at the moment. And that, until that changes, all of this is a bit academic, really.
Yes?
I think we should be able to say interesting things to the working class that are not just, you know, support the case of the world of Bolshevism or whatever it is. Because we do tend to not intervene in the day to day. And yet, for example, we could say very interesting things to the 800 or 1,000 people signing up for this new party or whatever it is, along the lines of, for example, why hasn't John McDonnell come over? You know, why haven't a couple of these other people come over? And the reason then becomes, it leads you into being able to explain that there's basically two routes down our economic society, like a profit against rent and interest, and the two parties basically fall over that, and they don't jump the tracks. So, you know, basically, if you are going to do what you want to do, you have to supplant the Labour Party at some point.
Yeah.
So, you know, It's useful as a pressure group outside to turn the Labour Party into the thing that you want, but you either have to be such a monster that you overthrow the Labour Party's 120-year history or whatever it is, yeah? Or at some point you're going to have to fold into the very thing you came out of, yeah? and then lead the discussion like that. So you're not telling them, oh, it's just the shadow play, you don't want to talk about that, you want to organise with us for, you know, the glorious day. You're allowing them to explore day-to-day politics in a way that's bringing them closer to a class consciousness, and we should have the confidence to say we don't have to bring them to our ideas. We need to bring the working class to their ideas, which will then bring us to our position. Because if we don't think that works, yeah, then we've misunderstood what the class struggle is.
Okay. I'll maybe take the other... Oh, no, they're gone. I mean, it's near enough quarter to. I mean, did you want to sort of sum up with any thoughts of your own? Again, I know the sort of conversation sort of strayed a bit. You know, perhaps we can sort of pick up some of these other threads through the weekend again. But yeah, any sort of closing remarks before we call it a night?
I think only to say a genuine thank you. I'm blown away by how wide-ranging the contributions have been, and I've probably got no more to say about them at this point than I've already said.
Right. Well, yeah, thanks very much. I'll say you'll be able to read a transcript of Keith's talk in the publication and his books on the shelf. But yeah, thanks again, Keith, for kicking off the weekend in such an interesting way. Yeah, thank you.